This is the Cinema for All podcast,
a celebration of going to the cinema
with Jack Chell and Abby Standish.
Welcome to the Cinema for All podcast. We're your hosts,
Jack Chell
and Abby Standish, and we're part of the Cinema for All team. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope that you've been enjoying what we've been putting together so far. We're nearly at 2,000 downloads. In fact, when this goes out, we might be there.
It's so exciting.
Thank you so much.
Also, have you checked out our mini-sodes? We've got quite a few now. The latest is an interview with the director of Matangi, Maya MIA, whose name is Steve. And our colleague Rosie took that one on because she absolutely loved the MIA documentary. Actually, Rosie's the voice at the start of the podcast who says, "Welcome to the Cinema for All podcast."
She is. She's the first person you ever heard when listening to this podcast.
So now you know.
This is it. I love the mini-sodes. They're kind of like great snacks or sides of a lovely meal.
I love it when you compare things to food, and especially buffet items.
Yeah, I think that's how I relate to most of the world. But first, though, before we get into it, if you want to find some community cinema joy, visit our website, cinemaforall.org.uk, or get in touch with us to find out how we can help you get your very own community cinema started.
We will help you! So today's episode is a little bit different to the one that we had planned that we mentioned in the last episode. So we're moving comedy and we're switching up to our queer cinema episode, which we're so excited about. We invited the truly wonderful Rico Johnson Sinclair up to Sheffield to record a segment for our queer cinema episode. And it was just so good and so interesting, we decided to just do it now and go with it now and change our episode order around.
We couldn't wait.
I know. But comedy is coming up soon. There's so much comedy going on in cinemas at the moment as part of the BFI comedy season. So keep your eyes and ears out. It's going to be happening soon anyway.
Yeah, exactly. What have you been watching?
What have I been watching?
I'm so intrigued because I know you mentioned a little bit about what you've been watching, and I know we told each other to shut our mouths and save it for the podcast.
This is the thing about the podcast. We have to stop conversations.
Because we're always talking about films.
Yeah, we should save that for the podcast. Yeah. That's good podcast banter. Save it.
So we're saving you all our sweet, sweet film nuggets here.
Yeah.
But mainly because I found one of them quite funny that you watched.
I don't know why you find it so funny.
It's just not what I expected to come out of your mouth when I said, "What did you watch the other night?"
I watched Gangs of New York the other night. Why? Why is this so funny?
Producer Jay is laughing. No one expect. I'm still shocked now. It's not because it's bad or anything. Mm. It's just I really didn't expect you to say that's what you spent your Wednesday night doing.
It was Sunday night. It was Sunday night. And I was looking through Netflix and I said to my husband, "Oh, I've got Fancy Gangs in New York." And he's like, "It's too long. We'll watch it in two halves." And we didn't. We just stayed up till 1 o'clock in the morning watching Gangs in New York on Sunday.
Commitment.
Yeah, Gangs of New York.
Tell me about it, Jack. I've seen it a long time ago.
I don't know why I'd never seen it, because I am a Scorsese fan. Well, some Scorsese.
Oh, you've never seen it before
this?
No,
I don't like Wolf of Wall Street, but Goodfellas is one of my favourite films
of all time.
Because of the soundtrack, because of the acting, because of the cast. It's just, I love Goodfellas so much. Fun fact, the little piano coda from Layla that plays at the end of Goodfellas, I'm going to play that at my funeral.
Wow. We're what, 5 minutes in?
I know. I'm so morbid.
No,
but it's
fine.
Just such a great song.
It is a great song. Yeah.
Play that
great choice.
Funeral, please. But Gangs of New York, I think it's really dated, actually. It was a film from 2002, but it very much feels like a 90s film. And a lot of the camera angles are just a bit rubbish. It just doesn't look very good. And I like Thelma very much, Martin Scorsese's editor.
She's a great
editor.
They
have a lifelong relationship, but this film's not very well edited. There's some bits of scenes that just don't clip together properly and the pacing's off. I don't know what happened. It's enjoyable. It was still like a good 3 hours of, I wasn't bored at all. And I really, really did enjoy the performances. Maybe Leonardo DiCaprio, not so much. And maybe the accents, not at all, actually. But it was still a really entertaining Sunday night film. I think I did want a lot more, though.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think with Scorsese, what's good about him is he, of many things, but like he explores lots of different filmmaking techniques quite consistently in his filmmaking career. Like with Hugo, he tested all the 3D stuff and everything. And I feel like maybe Gangs of New York was his time to like, ooh, well, what can we do with the editing and the camera work on this one and make this kind of more period sort of gang drama appeal to maybe a younger audience at that time. I'm not sure. That maybe I'm.
I think those sorts of techniques work in his other films. So Goodfellas has got a lot of weird camera angles and a lot of like snappy editing, a lot of montages.
Yeah.
And it works really well, I think, because of the time period. And the same for Wolf of Wall Street, actually. Mm-hmm. I do enjoy the editing of that film. And I do enjoy all the weird camera angles and the talking to camera. But it didn't work for Gangs of New York for me. Because of the period, I think.
Yeah.
Well, just terrible accents. I cannot get past some of those accents.
What else have you been watching?
Well, I have actually been out of the house to the pictures.
Dun, dun, dun. So what did you see?
I saw the new Halloween. So Halloween Amazing. 2018, disregards all the other Halloween sequels and just goes as a sequel to the original Halloween with Jamie Lee Curtis, the very first Michael Myers film. It was actually great. It was brilliant to see Jamie Lee Curtis sort of back on the big screen, doing a thing, being a badass. It was really, really special, actually. It's a very well put together film. A good clean 90 minutes, very scary.
Clean 90 minutes? Clean that 90... gives me a film, a whole star for me.
Oh, yes. I like a 3-minute song and I like a 90 minute film.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love a long film when it's right, but 90 minutes when you just. It just
satisfying.
Gives... Oh, it's very satisfying.
It is.
Yeah.
But this was like that. It was really, really well written. It was co-written by Danny McBride, you know?
I know Danny McBride. I love Danny McBride.
I love Danny McBride
from
too.
The kind of like Seth Rogen era of comedians, but a bit less known in terms of maybe what he's done.
He's done a lot of TV shows, done Eastbound and Down and Vice Principals, which is excellent.
That's right.
So it had like a nice humorous element, but it was also just really well done. Not too many twists and turns, just a good horror film.
And you love the music, don't you?
Love the music.
The soundtrack.
I mean, Halloween's got a great soundtrack anyway, but John Carpenter's revisited his own music to kind of do it again. And it's great.
He's such
a nice kind of want to dance to it. It's so good.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to come to that disco. I feel like John Carpenter is such a good example of a auteur, especially within the horror genre.
Yes.
And so many people have sort of magpied some of his ideas and what he's done, but the soundtrack and him being the director, those two things just seem to be a perfect sort of stream running through the film to really make it have that impact that we don't forget. I love all the promo for Halloween as well. Have you seen it? Like Jamie Lee Curtis as she is now as a middle-aged lady with a picture of her when she was younger in the first Halloween and their foreheads together like best friends.
Oh, what? No, I've not seen that. I've seen all the interviews with her and she's just so funny.
She's great.
Total sass attack.
Wife of Christopher Guest, who makes excellent comedy films, which we'll talk about in the next episode.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah. And anything else? Spooky themed?
I have been watching the spooky films. So I watched Bram Stoker's Dracula. Boy, that is a dated film also. It's actually hilarious.
This isn't the Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
Whoa, the Keanu Reeves we're known a writer one.
Yeah.
And Gary Oldman, a lot of prosthetics again.
He's a very stylized Dracula. He looks a very certain way, which is actually highly entertaining. Now, that's a film with some bad accents in actually.
It's a bit of a 90s dream there with the cast and...
super duper 90s.
Yeah.
It's super 90s. But I was not bored at all, but that has dated massively as well. It's got some very cheesy dialogue. Also, I actually didn't feel that Dracula was such a bad guy at the end. I was like, why can't we just let him do his thing? He's not hurting that many people.
Not that many. This was after Interview with the Vampire, wasn't it?
I think it was maybe the same year, actually.
Was it?
It's definitely the same era.
It's got that kind of cinematography and similar sort of
style. But Interview with the Vampire hasn't dated as much at all.
No.
It's actually genuinely quite scary and affecting when you watch Interview with a Vampire, whereas Bram Stoker's Dracula is kind of just silly.
And in Interview with a Vampire, aren't they playing with some slight queer themes there between...
Ooh.
I thought so. Maybe I'm wrong. It's been a long time since I've seen it, so we won't go. Don't quote me on that one.
What about you? What have you been watching?
Well, I haven't been getting out and about as much just because I've been so busy. Not because I haven't wanted to go to the cinema, but I've watched a few great things at home. So I rewatched Grey Gardens.
Oh, you love Grey Gardens so
number
much.
One documentary.
Oh, we have to do a documentary episode.
We really do. Yeah. Really do. That and American Movie are some of my favourite documentaries. But Grey Gardens, if you haven't seen it, is about this mother and daughter, but the daughter's like in her 50s and the mother's in her like 70s, 80s. And they were a really well-to-do family in the Hamptons. And the husband of the mother was cousins with Jackie O, right?
Yeah, they're part of the Kennedy Onassis family.
Yeah, yeah.
Bouviers.
Yeah, that's it, the Bouvier. In fact, Marge Simpson is Marge Bouvier, maiden name, influenced by that.
Excellent fact.
Excellent fact, Simpsons facts. But this is about them as they've got older and they live in this dilapidated mansion because they've no longer got any money, and it's just their relationship. But these are two of the best people I think we've ever had the chance to meet on screen. Absolutely excellent. Please do watch it if you get a chance. Criterion did a really nice re-release of that with extra bits.
It's brilliant. It's one of the best documentaries ever made.
And the voice, that really wonderful, strange accent you don't hear so much. Of sort of like high society Hampton.
Boston,
New York, New England. Sort of like, I can't do it. I'm not going to try.
Mother darling.
Yeah. I love singing, dancing in the Catholic Church. She was a staunch woman.
She was very staunch.
Staunch. Yeah, no, it's awful accent there. And I watched Beach Rats as well, which was a really cool film that came out last year, I want to say. Female filmmaker, indie film. And it's also a queer film. Mm-hmm. It's about a young man, and he lives in Coney Island, and it's a film that explores masculinity more than anything, and sexuality within that as well. Oh. And I thought it was really, really good. It's one of those films where not a lot happens in terms of how we might used to be in plot-wise, but I love those films. So a really great exploration of masculinity. And producer Jay and I were saying that our favourite films exploring masculinity are made by women.
Ooh,
which is quite interesting. Like The Rider.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also watched Princess...
Just got to get The Rider in there again.
Just got to get The Rider in there anytime I can.
Any horse puns?
Sorry?
Any horse puns?
Any horse puns? Nay today.
Oh, God.
Sorry. Why the long face? I'll stop. Princess Sid is another film I saw on Netflix. Just a nice, sweet little film. Again, a queer film about a young girl who visits her aunt in Chicago. She's thinking about going to college there, and along the way, she's discovering a bit about her sexuality. So it's a bit of a coming of age film, but nice little film. Very 2000s, but good.
Ooh, they sound good.
Yeah.
Okay, well, there's loads of great films coming up in November.
Loads.
Shall we talk about what's coming out?
Yes, please. So we've got Widows.
Yeah, Widows, new Steve McQueen film. So Steve McQueen's the director of 12 Years a Slave and Hunger and Shame.
Right.
A lot of films that he's made with Fassbender, but Fassbender's not in this one. This is a Viola Davis film.
Oh, hello, Viola Davis. Hail the Queen.
Everything she touches is gold.
Really is.
Yeah.
One of our favourite things Viola Davis has done is when she's at the premiere of Lion, which is a great film.
Yes.
And she's hugging Sonny Pawar, the little kid from Lion.
She just can't handle how cute he is. Him. And that he's there and he's okay.
Yeah, really
she can hug him.
Yeah, really resonated with her there. Yeah. But also her incredible acting skills.
Yeah.
Boy, does she shine.
She does. She's an incredible actor, an incredible presence, and she's just being everything and have all the awards.
I'm really excited about it to see what is following up from 12 Years a Slave that swept the Oscars. Mm. I don't doubt that this is going to be at least nominated and just let Viola Davis act herself and everyone off the screen.
Oh, it's going to be a big awards season. There's a lot of big films coming out.
It is.
It's going to be tough up there for those top awards.
I'm so
this
excited.
Year. Me too.
Some Like It Hot's getting re-released.
Do you know what? I just recently watched it on Netflix, actually. So I'm a little bit disappointed I didn't see that it was going to be on the big screen again.
Would you go again?
Yeah, you know.
I'm definitely going to go and see it on the big
it's
screen.
It's just so good. I think when I worked in a cinema over 10 years ago, we would show Some Like It Hot all the time and it would pack in the crowds. And it became a little bit frustrating that it was like, oh, show Some Like It Hot again. But it was one of my favourite films growing up and it hasn't dated. It's so funny. It's just so good to watch.
Wonderful example of some classic Hollywood comedy there.
Yeah.
And also it's got Tony Curtis in it.
Yes.
And Tony Curtis has a bit of a relationship with us in terms of back in the day, he presented one of the awards, didn't he?
He did, yeah. Before our time. Can
before
you imagine
our
if
time.
We'd have had the opportunity to meet Tony Curtis?
Yeah, Jack, why don't we get Tony Curtis and Debbie Reynolds anymore?
I know, sorry.
We need to big up to change that game. No, I'm joking. And there's Mike Lee's new film, Peterloo.
So
I'm a big Mike Lee fan, are you?
I am not a huge Mike Lee fan, but I think that maybe I haven't watched loads of them, but you've been rewatching a few lately, haven't you?
Yeah, I really prefer sort of his earlier 80s, 90s films, I will say. His other ones are nice, but they don't sit with me as much. So, but Alison Steadman is my favourite reason why I like Mike Lee.
That's true, actually.
I rewatched Nuts in May. I'm not going to talk about it too much because I'm going to save it for the comedy episode.
Can you do the impression, please?
Again?
No.
Keith, what's the treat?
Close Mushrooms, my favourite.
That's it's not that great. Alison Steadman's just incredible. So Mike Lee did these amazing play for Today, which is a thing that happened on television where it's to get new up-and-coming British filmmakers like Ken Loach is another one, and writers on the screen and hopefully get things developed from there. So Abigail's Party is another great example of his excellent work.
You're not named after Abigail's Party, are you?
I'm not. I wish I could claim that's true. But yeah, Alison Steadman again, being brilliant in that. Yeah. But I'm not sure about Peter Luke.
It's a massacre of people who were protesting in Manchester, and they were protesting conditions, particularly to do with industry in Manchester at the time. And they were massacred by essentially the police, but they were kind of like police on horseback and they had bayonets.
Yeah.
And so it was a murder of protesters, basically.
Okay.
So it's not Waterloo, it's Peterloo. So it was a pun on Waterloo because it was like another battle that had happened, but they were very much civilians.
It's a protest battle.
And some of them were trampled by horses and some of them were just literally bayoneted by soldiers. A really grim time period, but something that's quite relevant today and sort of the power of protest and people getting out there and sometimes maybe endangering themselves to fight for what they believe in. So that brings us on to the next film that we're going to talk about that's coming out soon, which is also about acts of protest, Ne Passaran. So our listeners might have heard our little interview that we did with Felipe Bustos Sierra, who's the director of Ne Passaran.
That's right.
But it's actually getting a much wider release now, which is very exciting because when we met with him, it was just a small tour that he was doing, but it was to sold out audiences all over the country. So really excited that this is getting a big release.
Don't you just love it when that happens? When you know that a film has been put there and they're just testing it out.
Yeah.
And audiences teach everybody that we want it.
Yes.
So see, you speaking as audiences is so powerful. We have talked about that a lot on this podcast, but that's getting this excellent Scottish documentary into more cinemas, giving more people a chance to enjoy it.
Yeah. So the documentary is about a group of Scottish workers at the Rolls-Royce factory in Scotland, and they refuse to do maintenance work on some Hunter Hawker jets that were being used in the Pinochet regime. And it was a relatively small act of resistance, a peaceful act of resistance, but it made a massive impact all around the world, and especially in Chile, where people were being very horribly oppressed and couldn't protest themselves. So it's a really fascinating film, and it's been told very interestingly as well, as Felipe tries to draw the men out into acknowledging the role and the kind of the hero status that they have, especially in Chile, and the lives that this really impacted on. So it's a really, really good one, and people should go out find that if they can.
Yeah, definitely. I think that and MIA have that sort of really interesting thing at looking at the process of making a documentary and have that sort of on screen for you to sort of see a little bit, which is great. There's also, from the 16th of November, 9 to 5 re-release.
Ah, Dolly!
Working 9 to 5. No, we won't go into it, but Dolly's here. And we're so happy about it.
Dolly, Lily Tomlin, Jane Fonda.
The dream team.
It is. I watched that film a lot when I was a teenager. I taped it off of Channel 4 and I watched it constantly. It is a very, very funny film. And
definitely.
Super empowering, very silly, but just brilliant. And boy, does Dolly look incredible at that era of her life. Her hair
really
is amazing. She's just super compelling.
Dolly Parton's is brilliant because she's this package of everything that exists. She's this glam, country, excellent songwriter and singer.
Have you heard the rumour that she's secretly covered in tattoos? Because it fascinates me.
Yes. Tattoos and rhinestones, baby.
Yeah, she's absolutely smothered in apparently very beautiful pink flowers and butterflies, but she keeps it all under wraps and nobody will ever publicly see.
Wow. Just for Dolly.
Just for Dolly.
I like that. She deserves that.
Yeah, she does.
And then she got that reading group in Rotherham going as well.
Yeah, she does. She really cares about literacy and for kids in Rotherham, which is close to our hearts. It's close to Sheffield, so...
Just it's going to be so interesting to see that star power in Lily Tomlin all on the big screen again from this like older film.
Yeah.
So definitely go and see that if you can.
Yes.
So that's what's coming out. A whole host of exciting things, spooky things, comedy things.
Yeah. It's a good time to go to the cinema, really. I love going to the cinema in November.
Yeah.
It's dark when you leave the cinema. It's great.
It's quite magical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this episode, we're talking about queer cinema, by which we mean films about and by queer people. So we're using the term queer here to cover the whole spectrum of the LGBTQIA+ community the way it's used in academic, literary and film contexts. But also, as Rico explains in the segment, it's a way a lot of people nowadays who might be homosexual prefer to self-identify for a variety of reasons. So before we get into the piece with Rico, in which we in particular focus on experiences and films about queer people of colour, Abby and I wanted to have a catch-up and talk about some of our favourite examples of queer cinema and queer filmmaking. Abby, we're big fans, aren't we?
Huge fans. I often think that so much of the films I love have a queer storyline, yeah, or they're by a queer filmmaker, and it's just because they're offering stories that are so intriguing, whether they're directly talking about a queer lifestyle or a coming-of-age story about being queer. It doesn't matter what sort of way it comes, I sort of always really, really enjoy it.
Yeah.
So we were chatting, weren't we, in the office about the different types of queer films that are out there.
I feel like we're always chatting in the office about queer cinema, to be honest.
We are. And you sort of thought about some of the sort of categories and things as well that we could put it into.
I mean, some of my favourites, I love the camp classics. Mm-hmm. I love the really colourful ones, especially if they feature a lot of drag. So
what are we talking?
Growing up, I watched The Birdcage a lot on repeat.
Great film.
Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Great.
Tu Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything,
Julie Newmar. Excellent film.
I went to see that at the cinema when I was about 15 and just loved it so much, even though it's got the stupidest title in the history of cinema.
Wesley Snipes,
Patrick Swayze, John Leguizamo.
Like a drag rove movie, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically Priscilla, but in America. Yeah. It's also got Stockard Channing in, who is incredible.
Also known as Rizzo.
Rizzo from Greece.
There are worse things we could do.
And then a little bit later, but Hedwig and the Angry Inch, which is a musical as well. It's just got some of the best songs of all time. Those are some of my favourites of that kind of era. I think they really spoke to me as a teenager because I was kind of a little bit shy, and I think I looked up to these very flamboyant, very out characters. So I would just watch those on repeat all the time. What about you?
I also love those films, but I like a lot of sort of maybe like comedies, like But I'm a Cheerleader.
Yes,
really
that's
great
a classic.
Film. Really good film. It's got Queen RuPaul in it.
It does have RuPaul in it. Of course it does.
Playing a counsellor.
Guidance counsellor,
Who's to get the gay out of people, basically.
Yes.
And that's it's these horrendous gay conversion camps that they send them to, but this is a whole comedy sort of twist on it.
Yeah.
And it's a really, really great film.
It is great.
And also got Natasha Lyonne in there.
Yes.
Really great actress.
She should be in loads more.
She should be in everything, please. And I also really like Coming of Age queer stories. Things like Moonlight, Call Me By Your Name is the more recent ones, but Beach Rats, which you just mentioned, but also there's this really wonderful film called The Way He Looks, which is a lovely Brazilian film about a young man and him coming to terms with his sexuality, but it's a very positive, light-hearted film as well.
I think it's important that a lot of modern queer films are positive, because there's definitely a humongous era where films featuring gay people just had them dying, or there'd be some kind of tragedy, and sometimes it would be age related, or sometimes it would be like in Brokeback Mountain, that's kind of a hate crime that happens in that one instead. So it's kind of hard for us. We were asked very recently by a community cinema to come up with some suggested titles of LGBT films with positive storylines. And boy, it was difficult to find some. It really was. But those kind of more modern films, although they have tragedy in them and sadness in them, there's much more positivity than I think maybe you would have had sort of 15 years ago, 20 years ago. That's what I love about Call Me By Your Name, actually, that it's a beautiful story and it's very sexy and it's very real.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily have to have a really, really tragic twist in order for it to still be an impactful film, which I think a lot of previous films that were featured gay men would have had. And I do think there's a place for those films that do tell stories of tragedy, and I think it's really important to tell the stories, particularly of the AIDS crisis, because I think that modern people forget how truly devastating that era was, an entire generation of gay men completely wiped out.
Yeah.
Terrible, terrible things. I follow a really beautiful Instagram account called The AIDS Memorial that tells individual stories. And so I think it's important that people remember that time and remember those stories. The recent film that came out called 120 Beats Per Minute, which is a French film that was specifically about ACT UP being founded in France and protest and trying to get people medication and trying to get the government to pay attention to them. So those films are still extremely important.
Definitely.
But I think that what we would love to see is much more examples of positivity and just stories of people's lives that don't have to be entwined with tragedy and don't have to be intertwined with crisis.
Yeah, so just not following all the traditional tropes. When, yeah. when we were trying to think of queer films about women,
yeah.
a lot of them are, you know, at the end of the film, they go back to, quote, being straight again.
The straight line,
you know,
yeah.
or, you know, it was a phase and things like this. And it can be a little bit undermining to see that when we get a lot of rom-coms that feature straight characters.
Yeah.
And that's not really something that is coming up into play, and the jeopardy of that authenticity isn't there.
Yeah.
As it might be for a particular queer film. So yeah, it'd be lovely just to see some, like Love, Simon was the most example of an all and all out sort of rom-com for as a queer film.
It's quite an interesting one. It's a really big blockbuster as well. I think
Huge.
Maybe the first kind of blockbuster that kind of dealt with those sorts of themes.
Yeah. And I went to see it and I didn't know anything about it, didn't know anything about the book, because it's based on a young adult novel. All the young people in the audience were reacting so like audibly. Like,
really?
Like, you know, sort of squeeing when, you know, the love interests get together,
yeah.
and just sort of like little claps and things like that, and just like, oh, you know, like really reacting to it the way that they've obviously adapted to the book so much. So it was incredibly important for those young people to see that on screen as well. So whilst it's not my favourite film, it's definitely got a place for audiences that it relates to. Yeah.
I think a lot of the films that we've been talking about so far have been about gay men. And again, it's perhaps because we have struggled to find a lot of really great examples of films about gay women, actually. I mean, one of your faves is Carol.
Adore it. Adore
Love
it so
Carol.
Much. I had to like stop myself from watching it like four times a year. I saw it in the cinema four times.
Wow.
It was kind of by accident, because different friends went, oh, do you want to go see something? Do you want to see Carol? And I was like, yes, I'll watch it again.
I do want to watch it again.
And it
yes.
just got better and better after every watch. But I think it's because it's been so long since we've seen a film with a positive ending, a hopeful ending for queer characters on the cinema screen, especially with such huge actors like Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful film. And I think what's so great about it is, again, we talked a bit about this with Rico, about the fact the people working on the film are queer themselves. So Todd Haynes is gay, and he's the director, an excellent filmmaker. And he's brought that, he's talked about in interviews how he would speak to a lot of women that had seen it who were lesbians, and said that it's the first time they've seen a sort of lesbian love scene actually feel reflective of real life as well, and things like that.
I suppose that brings to mind Blue is the Warmest Colour, which is a controversial example of a film directed by a man which features extended sex sequences that he's filmed that are very much through his gaze.
Yeah, male gaze,
And the actors in that film definitely reported feeling exploited by him in those scenes and in the film as a whole, really. And it's a bit of a weird one, because I think when I watched Blue is the Warmest Colour, I think I enjoyed it at the time, but definitely feeling that those actors were exploited and were unhappy with what's happening. It's completely soured me on that film, and I don't want to watch it anymore.
Yeah, exactly. You want to hear, I think, again, so one thing, seeing Carol, say if you are a queer woman and you've seen it, it can be quite positive to you to finally see a happy ending. You know, a character hasn't died or gone back to a husband or whatever it might be. And also to see that a director that's gay has had a success in the film industry as well.
And that they're creating safe spaces for those actors to be in as well. That actually does make a difference to me as a viewer to know that the queer experiences are being listened to, they're being filmed properly, and that the actors are feeling comfortable and that they can express themselves properly in that moment.
Yeah, precisely. Like, we've talked about Miseducation of Cameron Post an awful lot on this podcast, but
it's because we love it.
Yeah, it is a really, really great film, and just getting to see all that representation on the screen and off the screen, and the magic it makes of the stories that we get to see.
It does make a difference. They're better films. I think objectively they are better films if it's a queer story that's been told by a queer filmmaker, which again, that's something that we talk about in the segment with Rico.
Absolutely.
But just touching back on Cameron Post, the director Desiree Akhavan, very famously, her other film is Appropriate Behaviour. Again, well, the few examples that we can think of that tell a bisexual story.
Yeah, so few and far between to get those in any media, but definitely in film.
And they're definitely examples of, as you were saying, with films that might feature lesbians, they might go back to the straight life afterwards. You definitely see that in films that feature bisexual people. Mm-hmm. The way that it's depicted is that their sexuality is an experiment, and that they are either completely gay or they're either completely straight, and they're just struggling or confused, which is absolutely not true about bisexual people.
Absolutely.
But there's just not very many examples of bisexual characters in film. So Appropriate Behaviour is the one that kind of stands out. But yeah. Appropriate Behaviour is so good.
And it's a comedy. Again, you're not always getting loads of comedy films generally, but especially things that are exploring other things like sexuality as well, which is a wonderful realm to have a look at something set like that, something that is so important. And it can definitely unite audiences. But yeah, it's such a good film.
It is. My favourite bit in that film is when she helps a bunch of little boys make a film and they just make it about zombies that fart. And when I watched that at the cinema, I was just in pieces. Nobody else was laughing at me.
And when we're looking at queer cinema, there's even less representation of trans characters and trans stories.
In particular, trans characters that are played by trans people.
Yeah.
As we know, very famously, Jared Leto won an Oscar for playing a trans character in Dallas Buyers Club.
Yeah.
And then when he won his Oscar, didn't even mention trans people or trans rights. It made me livid.
Yeah, yeah.
Truly livid.
There's a lot of movement to make in this area. Yeah,
I think people are getting there.
Yeah. Tangerine, for example.
Yes.
Comedy again.
Yeah.
Actually featuring a trans actor playing a trans character.
Yeah.
And she was nominated for, I think she won the British, no, sorry, she won the Spirit Independent Spirit Award.
Oh, yeah.
For Best Actress, I think. Mm. Don't quote me on that, but I'm sure she won an award. Yeah. So, rightfully so. That's the director of the Florida Project that did that one.
Oh, brilliant. And then also the winner of the Best Foreign Language Picture at last year's Oscars, A Fantastic Woman.
A Fantastic Woman by Sebastian
Lalo.
Yes.
Yeah, who directed Gloria.
Yeah. Really, Disobedience is just coming up.
Yeah, yep. Fantastic filmmaker, actually. And again, featuring a trans actress playing a trans character, Daniela Vega. Mm-hmm. And when she presented an award at the Oscars, so obviously it won that night, but she was also an awards presenter. It was quite a special moment. It was the first time a trans person had presented an Oscar at the Oscar ceremony. I know I've mentioned the Oscars a lot today, but I'm a massive Oscars fan.
We're getting there, you see.
And yeah, Fantastic Woman is a great film, and I hope that it kind of leads by example and that more casting follows that trend.
Yeah, because that's obviously added something to that film.
Absolutely.
And so many community cinemas screened that, actually.
Yes, they
and
do.
And they loved it. Good
Definitely.
For them.
I think they're big Sebastian Lalo fans in the community cinema movement. They love Gloria. So it would be interesting to see how Disobedience does.
Yeah, definitely. There's so many great queer films out there. We haven't even touched upon everything we want to talk about. John Waters.
John Waters is my hero.
All the great documentaries.
Let's do a John Waters episode one day.
Yeah, we will do that for your birthday. So let's get into the segment with Rico.
Yes.
Wasn't it just the biggest joy to have him with us?
It really was. You know, Rico is a great human being.
He gives brilliant hugs.
The greatest hug I've ever had in my life has been from Rico. Just real tight hugger. But also, he's a very talented film programmer.
Yep.
He really knows his stuff. He really knows his cinema. And more importantly, he really knows his audience.
Yes.
And really connects with what they might know and what they want to see. And as a result, he's just bringing some great cinema to Birmingham, particularly queer cinema, particularly telling stories of people of colour.
Yep.
So we just had to get him here and talk to him, didn't we?
We did. This is a man that says in this segment he watches about 600 films a year.
Yeah, one in the morning, one at tea time.
Yeah, yeah. And he watches them twice quite often to make sure he's really looked at the film.
Yeah, a dedicated film fan.
So I hope that you really enjoyed this, like you say, about films, about audiences, and it's just really great. I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, let's get into
Let's get into it.
We're here with Rico Johnson Sinclair, who runs CineQ in Birmingham, which is a fantastic screening night focusing on showing queer cinema, in particular showcasing queer cinema featuring people of colour. Rico, welcome. Welcome to the Cinema for All podcast.
Welcome, Rico.
So in today's episode, we're talking about queer cinema, which is kind of a kind of cinema very close to our heart here at Cinema for All. So tell us about yourself, first of all, Rico.
Okay. I am a 28-year-old queer person of colour. I identify as queer because historically the LGBT community hasn't been that welcoming for people of colour. And so I don't feel like I really aspire to it. So I use the classification of queer, and that isn't without its difficulties. A lot of the older generation don't like the term queer because it spans from obviously their less fortunate times, maybe bullying in younger years. I am a programmer for CineQ. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in exploring expanded cinema as well. And so my background is I grew up in a single parent household, poor family.
Shout out to the single parents.
Yes.
Shout out.
quite a poor family. And so really my first foray into film was when my auntie took me to go see Recess Schools Out at the cinema.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is that a feature-length film?
Recess film.
Yeah, it was a Recess film. Yeah.
Recess is great.
Yeah.
I need to see the film.
see it. And so that was like my first understanding that like film could be this really long enjoyment experience, I guess. And so I then went from that to, because we were poor and a single income family, we went to the DVD man down the road, the pirate DVD man, and got 3 DVDs for a fiver. And so we used to watch them on the DVD player, and that was my first experience of film, and that used to be the blockbusters. So like when Saw came out or Hostel came out, and so my first really enjoyable types of film, I used to love horror films.
Yeah,
but obviously the thing is, when you watch a lot of horror films, you become really desensitized to them.
Yeah, it's true.
So I started to like diversify my film choices, and then I obviously came out as queer or as gay at the time, and really the only thing that I could see reflecting a gay experience on TV was soap operas. To be honest, soap opera storylines. And I did my dissertation actually at university on the normalization of queer culture through soap operas, and found out that the way that they normalize things is through routine and through immersion, because it's something you talk about with your friends, because it's something that's always present. It actually becomes a part of your life, and you can kind of empathize with it but still stay detached from it. So it was a really good vehicle in like normalizing queer culture. And there was a distinct difference from the way that my mom treated me before and after these storylines came on. So I was really interested by that.
That's fascinating. When we were talking to Delphine on the previous episode, when we were talking about representation and seeing yourself on screen, we were saying you're more likely as a person of colour to see yourself represented on screen on the small screen than on the big screen.
Yeah.
But growing up, did you see any big kind of big screen movies where there was somebody like you?
No. I didn't see any representations of a queer person of colour. I didn't. And similarly, I didn't see any positive representations of people of colour. They were all stereotypes of like the ghetto, the thug, the murderer, the violent man, or there were caricatures of culture. So the Jamaican woman, and similarly with Southern Asian characters, it was pretty much the same. So they're all negative or stereotypical. Mm-hmm. And I think that definitely changed my way of living, because I think when there's no visibility for someone that looks like you, or when someone that is like you, you kind of assimilate to the thing that closely represents what you are. And at that point, because I was no longer speaking to my family, it was very much the LGBT community. And so I started acting, I guess, like a air quotes white gay. Mm-hmm. And found out that loads of these spaces that were for gay people were specifically for white gay people, and I would never be allowed to be like them. And so that definitely created a divide inside myself. And so I thought I was supposed to act this way and I wasn't allowed to act this way. It was very much that kind of that discourse that we have a lot now where you're too black to be gay and too gay to be black. And yeah. So there was a really divide, a really big divide inside me. And I don't really think that has ever fully been reconciled.
Mm-hmm. Is there a film, do you remember an experience watching a film where that gave you a sign that could change or has changed?
Well, actually, I recently watched a film called Tongues Untied.
What's that about?
And so it's all from the perspective of queer people of colour, queer men of colour, talking about the exact thing that I'd experienced. It was about the big white gay presence of in multimedia. And so it's told through spoken word. It's a short film. It was recently circulated on the ICA. And yeah, it just follows the story of one man from the time that he came out to the time that he originally gets diagnosed with HIV. I didn't want to ruin the ending then. I was like,
spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was really powerful for me because it was the first time I saw reflected on screen my personal experience. But then also it hit the nail on the head so well. And it ended the film by saying, like, when you learn to live another black person is when you really learn to live yourself. Because what I realised is inside myself, I'd always had a disgust at the fact that I was black because, like, that's what had been kind of drilled into me. So, yeah, it was really good.
That's amazing that you saw a film that could resonate with you in that way. And you've just mentioned the ICA there, that you caught that in circulation there, and they do a really good job of getting these
fantastic
films that are just not really seen or screened anywhere else. And we were talking about that, about access to films. So even though there are a few films that exist that offer us different representations, especially within queer culture, we were talked about Pariah, didn't we, on the last podcast with Delphine, and talked about how that isn't or wasn't very recently accessible in the UK to actually watch properly, like legally, and how that causes a problem. So just generally queer films and queer films that represent people of colour, how easy or difficult are they to actually find out about and then to watch?
Yeah, so I find extreme difficulty in getting hands on this film because they're not available in the UK, and so sometimes most of the time I have to approach filmmakers directly. I think that's why I find it so much easier to program short films, because a lot of short films from queer people of colour's perspectives are being made. It's a lot easier to reach out to the filmmakers directly and be like, can I have this as part of my program, and have that discourse with the filmmaker. I think it's like we were talking about Tongues Untied. I saw that like last year. The film is actually from like 1995, so it took till now for the ICA to be like, right, this needs to be seen and to circulate it. And if they hadn't, I wouldn't have seen it, and that really resonated with me in such a deep way that I'm really glad I saw it. And so yeah, it is a thing about access, but bigger than that, I think it's a problem with access generally for queer films. I think we for exhibition sector especially, we want people to come and see films on the big screen because that's what is best. Like,
absolutely, yeah.
Like having no distraction, sitting in the cinema and seeing it on a big screen, it's a whole experience, and it's one of the best experiences. And it's only recently, well, not recently, about 3 years ago, where I really felt that, because I was so used to watching so many films via Netflix and via Amazon Prime, that I got so used to it. But I realised that I'd actually like sit with my phone in my hand for half of it and like constantly checking my phone, or I wouldn't really be paying attention to the film. I'd be paying attention to other stuff and be like, oh, this film isn't really for me. But it was really because I wasn't giving it my whole focus. Yeah. And when I started Flatpak and started working under Amy Smart, and she was like, yeah, the best way to watch film is in the cinema, that was the only time that I'd, one, had a big enough wage for me to have the disposable income to go and watch films in cinema, because cinemas are quite expensive.
Cheap. Yeah.
And two, there was a lot of experiences that I had with Flatpak where I'd go and see films as part of my work.
Yeah.
And so that allowed me to see that she was right, because some of the films that I'd seen at home, I saw in the big screen, and it was a completely different experience. And seeing them with other people and talking with them afterwards is a completely different experience. But the problem lies obviously there with getting films for the big screen. Because when things are released to Netflix, it's it's just easy access, isn't it? Like going through distributors when you're especially when you're a community cinema, is extremely hard and very costly. And so sometimes it is easier to go off the beaten track a little bit and look for the films that haven't been seen, like Tongues Untied, that haven't had a release, where you can talk to the film, like make a direct link into some kind of agreement. And that's kind of what I did when I screened Check It for CineQ, because I, as far as I knew, Check It had only been screened in London twice. And it was a really powerful film. It had so many problems, but it was a really pivotal film to watch. And the plot is, so a group of disenfranchised people are estranged from their parents in Washington, D.C. and have to live on the streets. Because they keep getting attacked, they form a street gang to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. And so, but the story itself follows their road to recovery, another air quotes, through the voyeuristic gaze of two white filmmakers who don't really understand like the thing that they're filming, the content and context. And so it comes off really a bit awkward.
Yeah.
And there's this scene where one of the characters is talking on the phone to report his rape. Mm. And the filmmakers are very much like that far away from like her face.
Yeah.
So like really like in her face. And it's just like, oh, this is not a moment to be doing that. You need to have. And so it kind of asks that question, like, should films, especially documentary films, I think it's especially important with documentary films, should films about queer experiences be filmed by people with queer experiences? Absolutely. And should films with queer people of colour's experiences be filmed specifically by queer people of colour?
Yeah.
And I personally think the answer is yes. I don't think it can be any other way. And if not the director, and if not the cinematographer, but they definitely have someone on the staff that has that experience and listen to what they say.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a film from the 60s, a documentary called Portrait of Jason. Do you know that one?
Vaguely.
It's a really phenomenal film. So there's this guy from the 60s. He's in New York. He's black. He's gay. He's a bit of a hustler. He might be a sex worker. They're basically the two white filmmakers put him in a hotel room and they get him really drunk and they get him to tell his fabulous stories, which of course are super entertaining, but the film becomes extremely complicated because he's being exploited for his stories, for his wit, for his tragedy, and he notices that as the night goes on and throws it back at them, and it becomes such an incredibly interesting film, but obviously with so many problems. But it's just great how he wrestles that power back from them and throws it back at them.
That's
it's
brilliant.
A really, really fascinating film.
I'm going to go home and watch that.
Yeah, it's me too.
One of Ingmar Bergman's favourite films.
Amazing.
Really, really bonkers. I was listening to the podcast Nancy the other day, and it was an interview with Samira Wiley, the actress who's in Orange is the New Black, and plays Moira in Handmaid's Tale.
Love her.
Was asked that question about queer people telling their own stories and queer, particularly being cast as queer actors, being cast in queer roles. And she said, well, until we're being cast in straight roles, then queer people need to play queer roles.
Round of applause.
You know, when that happens, then that's fine. Everybody can play everybody. But right now, I'm not being cast as straight people. So that needs to happen first. And, oh gosh, I just love her to bits.
She's
just, like, incredible. So when you're programming films for CineQ, where do you go about the research? How are you finding these films? Because they're quite hard to find films and hard films to know about.
They are. I have always been plugged into films that really resonate with my experience, and I'm lucky enough to have a really good network of people in Birmingham. Unmuted is like one of the communities that I like really am close to with CineQ, and Unmuted is a hub of people that are people of colour and queer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of have focus groups with them about the films that they've seen and really touch them, and then go out there and do a little bit of research. I look at other people's programmes as well, like Fringe in London's programme is always sensational.
Mm-hmm.
Also BFI Flare, even though the things they program for queer people of colour hasn't really been great over the last 2 years, but there are a couple of gems in there. I talk to other programmers on chance films that they've seen. Amy Smart, she got back from Cannes and told me about a brilliant film that she'd watched. And so doing like films like that, it's called Rafiki. And so doing communication within the industry with people that are plugged into people of colour's plight, but also doing talks outside of the industry and talking to my audience as well. That's such a big, important thing. Yeah. And I don't think a lot of film exhibitors or film programmers, they consider their audience, but they don't reach out to their audience in the same way. I think when you're a community cinema, you're quite lucky because you are catering directly for the community. Yeah. And the more you do events, the more you realise that some of the people come time after time after time. Yeah. And those are the people really engaged in queer film. So those are the people you really should ask about what they want you to see. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's really important.
How has your audience been reacting to what you've been screening so far?
Yeah. I mean, there's been a bit of feedback in terms of what I've screened isn't... hasn't got enough female representation, which I think is completely fair. Mm-hmm. I think when you're a queer person of colour that's male, you sometimes think that you are screening enough female films when you're not. Trying to rectify that with my last programme, which was all about the female gaze, mm-hmm. and it was a programme of shorts. But also, it's really difficult to find film that is available in the UK that is female-led and also has the perspectives of female people of colour. It's not on the same rate as male people of colour at all, which is quite disappointing.
It really is. We were saying this, just generally sort of female queer stories are usually lesser told, and must be even less for queer women of colour as well. We were recently helping a group who was setting up in Manchester, Queer Cinema Collective, and she wanted some suggestions of sort of queer women stories, and we really had to rack our brains, didn't we?
Yeah, she was particularly interested in positive ones as well, where it's happy not all endings. About sadness.
Positive and sexuality, loss.
We struggled.
It's upsetting because there are a lot of great films out there that do have those parts of their stories that are much more tragic, and they do need to be told. But I mean, I don't know how you feel, Rico, but there's just not enough variety of queer stories.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think the main problem of that is not enough queer people have been given the resources to be able to go out there and make their own films. I think once queer people start making their own films, because of the varied experiences that they have and they've experienced, they'll go out there and make films that have all these different perspectives that are multifaceted. Then stories will become really complex. I mean, I've always said, all of the mainstream gay films that I saw growing up to the age of 25 were all really negative, and most of them had HIV as a huge part of the story. And I think less stories, obviously, with women that are queer have HIV as such a big part of it. But I think there's been a formula that's grown from the male stories where people think people want to see gay films with all this horror in. And so, yeah, a lot of stories kind of consistently carry the same kind of flow, which is like really happy at the beginning, in the middle something happens, moment of happiness just before the end, and then someone dies.
And it can send quite a difficult message to see that there's no other things out there as assumed by the media. But I think what you were saying before about queer people actually making the films and being involved with it is a big thing, and I think Carol is one of the greatest mainstream examples of a good queer film, especially from a female perspective, just because the director's a gay man, the producer is a gay woman, the writer's a gay woman, and Patricia Highsmith was a gay novelist. And I think that has made a difference to that film. I don't doubt that it would have been an enjoyable film anyway, but I think there were definitely layers within it, and especially for a queer audience, that they would pick up in a much more open way, rather than just the case of, we've got to take what we can get, kind of, there's an undertone there, so we'll take it. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Recently, we were watching Muriel's Wedding.
Yes.
And we've decided to read that as a bit of a queer story at the, at the end.
Yeah. It is. You can't convince me otherwise.
Yeah. And we found out, Jack told me that there was a play of it.
Musical version,
A musical, and they've taken out some of those sort of queer undertones. Yeah, and that told us even more that it probably was a queer film than if they'd taken it away.
Yeah, mild spoilers for Muriel's Wedding, but they insert a male character into the end, Which is not how the musical should be. Yes.
Yeah, which doesn't happen in the film. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
No, it was very frustrating because it's such a great film. So shall we talk about some films?
Yeah.
I really recently saw a really great film, and it could be classified as queer.
Tell us.
But it's not really about the queer story. Mm. It's called Hearts Beat Loud. And so it's a new release.
Oh, has it got Nick Offerman in it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah,
it's really good. And so it's about a dad who works in a record store and he's living life, but he's becoming slowly more in debt. So he decides to pull out the record store. And also his daughter's going to college, obviously, which isn't cheap in America. Mm. And so during their last summer together, he's like, I'm closing the record store. I want to work with you. Let's like throw some tracks down. Let's jam. And then they make a track together and he sneakily puts it on Spotify. And the track is about her and the girl that she just met and how they've just like come together. And all of the queer bits of the story are all really like heartfelt and lovely. And then there's kind of a moment where she has a conversation with her dad and it's like her dad already knows that she's gay and it's not a big deal at all, which I thought was like way more powerful. But then also it's her last summer before she goes to college, and so she like makes a few more songs, and all the songs are about their kind of journey that she's going on in this queer relationship going on in the background, and how eventually she'll have to leave and the pain that she feels by that. And then in the end they perform in the record store and have like a closing down sale, and it's all really good. Aww. Yeah.
That sounds so nice.
Yeah. And it's got Nick Offerman in it, so that sounds brilliant.
Yeah. I will say that we're seeing one or two films that just immerse a queer story within the film, and it might not be the central story or plot point, which is fine. But so one of them was Blockers, that comedy that we talk about once or twice.
Oh, yeah. Why do we talk about Blockers so much?
I think it's because it looks like a gross-out comedy that we see all the time.
It's kind of a Judd Apatow vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But within it. So, like, you know, lots of people are going to go on a Friday night, probably a lot of young people. Well, I'm talking between maybe 16 and 40. That's probably the average age group to go and see that film. And probably a lot of straight people too. And I think that it's nice to show on screen other characters from other backgrounds immersed in a type of genre we're very used to, like you were saying about the soap operas. I think that can have a power of its own, that it's just, it is there, it's not being ignored, but it's just part of the story.
Yeah.
And this is a character just like in everyday life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also it kind of, it also kind of gives that kind of that feel that it can be acknowledged, but it doesn't have to be acknowledged, because let's be real, there are homophobes out there. And so I think constant exposure to homosexual storylines or queer storylines, LGBTQ plus storylines, I think is really important for homophobes to be like, okay, it exists, but I'm just going to ignore it, because if they can do it on the screen, they can do it in real life. Let's be real.
Yeah.
And even though obviously we're all fighting for acceptance, if we can't get acceptance, then at least leave me alone.
It's like what you were saying earlier with the soaps and how there's a notable difference in how people might treat you after they've seen certain storylines. Yeah. I think with Blockers, what was surprising for me is the dad's reaction to his daughter who comes out as gay. Well, she doesn't come out initially, but he knows and he's trying to protect her. And it's quite tender and really surprising, because everything else about that character, he's kind of gross and obnoxious.
Yeah.
But he's like quite a sweet dad, and he's trying to look out for her and just protect her against any kind of external pressures that might make her conform to something that she's not. Yeah. It's really surprising.
Yeah, it's very. I did not expect it to be within there.
Oh, sorry, everybody, for talking about Blockers here.
What do you think, Rico, to sort of, I guess, the biggest mainstream film that's come out that show not only queer people but queer people of colour is Love, Simon. Did you see it? Would you like to expand on that? That lovely note that came from your throat there.
I mean, the thing is about Love, Simon is, even though it does have a queer person of colour, it's never really noted in the duration of the film. He was like, you know, the first maybe.
Right.
And then he was thrown in at the end. It could have literally been anyone. There was no kind of reference to culture or how his culture was different from Simon's. It was so even though there was it felt very much of the kind of, let's stick a black person in there.
Yeah.
It had that kind of feel.
It is a bit cultureless in terms of, and right down from backgrounds to economical backgrounds.
Yeah.
I think, what do you think, I guess because it's based on a young adult novel, what do you think that has a potential to send some positive message, or do you think it's just, it is just touching the surface? It's not.
Yeah, I think.
Get delving deep.
I think the thing is, it does show that people of colour can be on equal footing with white people in a kind of safe, secure setting. I think when they go out into the world after school, there is a difference. I mean, I experienced racism when I was in school, like from many of my teachers. And so I think that for me, in this day and age, isn't a story that's particularly correct. And also in America, I just don't see it.
No. When I was watching it, I was thinking, is this what school is like now? Has everybody become nice?
Yeah, no.
I was a little bit unsure. Yeah, it's interesting. What are some of the queer films that you've grown up loving or even have seen recently that you just really enjoyed?
I don't know. Because the thing is, when you program films and you see queer films, you always look at it in two ways. Like, I always watch queer films twice. And you have to imagine, like, I watch, like, over 600 films a year. Mm-hmm. I watch, like, one in the morning, one in the evening before I go to bed.
You've told me about your home cinema. It sounds dreamy, but well taken on a test.
And so, like, I always watch it once with, like, a really shrewd intent, and then watch it the second time to like kind of enjoy it. But the shrewd intent always ruins the time that I actually want to enjoy it. So I guess some of the queer films that I've seen recently are The Cake Maker, but though I wouldn't really class that as a queer film because there's a queer bit at the beginning. I really love Those People, which is so far removed from the people of colour aspect of my programming. It's unreal. But it's also about like rich people in the Upper East, rich kids in the Upper East Side that become poor. And so yeah, I love that because I grew up on Gossip Girl, so guilty
like
pleasure. I also really like I'm really into series at the moment because I think a lot of the elements taken from films are slowly being put into TV series. And like with films, like my only gripe with films is that they end too soon. Why can't I just like watch films like all week? And with TV series, you kind of can, unless you binge watch it and then it like lasts 2 days. But it's two full days. It's like two whole days, everything. So like I watched the Spanish drama on Netflix called Elite, which has like two queer storylines. One's about like the polyamorous relationships, and then one's about just a standard gay relationship. But they bring in like social and economical differences into it. So one of them's like a drug dealer and the other one's like a really rich person. And it's like, and one of them's a person of colour who's Muslim, and one of them is just rich and atheist. So yeah, it's really interesting how that kind of evolves over the period of like, I don't know, like 5 weeks, I guess, but 2 days for me because I've binge-watched it. So yeah, these are all really interesting ways of kind of adding queer elements to like film feels, I guess that's the way I'd say it.
Do you reckon that because things like Netflix and Amazon, they have the power to get things created and distribute it, and they're taking a lot more chances that maybe even television generally would do, and maybe even sometimes films. Do you agree with, you know, you hear a lot about whether it's queer cinema or sort of female-led stories or whatever it might be, that, well, we just need to prove that there's an audience for it, and then, you know, everything will be okay.
Yeah.
And they said that about, I give the example a lot, but Bridesmaid, you know, that's the comedy that's proved that female-led comedies work as a box office success.
Yeah, but how much money was seeded into it before it got that audience?
We don't really see that again and again, do we? Yeah. And even less so for queer films and queer films with people of colour.
Yeah.
So, you know, you run screenings for this audience and you're getting audiences. What do you think about that kind of strange narrative?
I originally heard this narrative, and this was one of the reasons why I set up CineQ, because I was like, not enough queer films are coming to the cinema, and not enough queer films are being made, especially films about queer people of colour. So what I'm going to try and do is show there's an audience for it directly to the BFI, and then maybe they'll pay more attention to queer films that need to be told. But then what happened the following week, obviously, Call Me By... the following year, Call Me By Your Name came out, and then obviously it was just on the heels of Moonlight. And so there was this narrative where, like, it's kind of like, we've done enough. We don't have to do that anymore.
We did a gay film.
Yeah.
That honestly is a sentence that could get thrown around. Yeah.
No, it's a thing psychologically that exists. People think that one thing's happened and they never have to do it again. Exactly. So they think, for example, we elected a black president and that's it now. We don't have to think about that ever again. It's done and it's over with. Yeah. So it's almost that people go back the other way and resist, which is why films like Sorry to Bother You had such a hard time finding a distribution, because they were like, well, we've done a black film, actually.
Exactly. And the thing is, like, with rep film, which is most of queer film, because about three or four new queer films get made, and only probably two of them see the mainstream light of day. So the thing is about queer rep film is it never gets shown in film cinemas, both in, especially not in Birmingham, both independent and multiplex cinemas would just ignore it. And most of the kind of the good stories are in queer rep film, like New Queer Cinema. It was this whole movement because of stereotypes that were perpetuated by the Gay Liberation Front, like gays like hairdressing and gays like to go shopping. And New Queer Cinema is all about dismantling that kind of the damage from that and showing real queer storylines with the real kind of nitty gritty, like My Own Private Idaho. So like, I find that element of like that history of queer film really interesting. And even though it doesn't, it's not a queer person of colour's perspective, it is a perspective that I can closely resemble, because like, growing up, I didn't have to follow the same rules as white gays, because I wasn't accepted into that, so I had to struggle and find my own way. And that's more of a New Queer Cinema story, but there is no room for it. And so, and it isn't freely available. And sometimes you do need a cinema behind you to be able to get rights to things. Yeah. And so it's really about, well, for Cinecure especially, it's been about making partnerships with like cinemas. Like the Electric in Birmingham or the Mockingbird has been especially forthcoming because they're a new cinema, and trying to use them to leverage films that you want to go and see. But I think yeah, this narrative about having an audience and growing this audience and then you'll have things made, that's fine, but like, how closely are you paying attention to the activity that goes on in regions? I mean, yes, the hubs have been built and they've just had their parameters redrawn, and they're doing a lot of work in the community, but there's also, for every person in the community, there's also someone that can't afford to pay the film licenses and they're just showing films to random people like in small groups, and there is an audience and audiences going on. But when you've got so much red tape to what you can actually do, how do you expect people to show that? I mean, I have been in many situations where I've had to fund Cinecure for myself, like otherwise I'll miss like a 2 month, because I show it every 2 months, and so I've had to fund it myself just to get it out there. And some people aren't in those situations, especially people of colour, because we have a lot of barriers to like a sustainable, stable situation. And so many of us don't want to spend our expendable income on trying to get people into a certain kind of film. That's a passion that you can't have until you're at a stable situation if you're a person of colour. And so, yeah, this narrative is kind of harming, and it's also really close-minded and kind of yeah, superfluous, really, because it's just kind of like, it's glazing over it. It's just being like, you're too lazy to do the work yourself, so I'm just going to make you, they're too lazy to do the work themselves, so that I'm just going to make you do the work. And then if we still deem it necessary, I mean, like, I've been doing Cinecure for a year and a bit now. I know that there's loads of places that cater specifically for queer film, and I haven't seen the actual outtake of the output of queer film rise in the slightest. It's still pretty much ticking along at the same rate it's always been.
So you talk about the kind of importance of partnerships there and working with other groups and partnerships with cinemas. Do you want to tell us what's going on tonight then?
Yeah, so we have an event at Showroom Cinema here in Sheffield. It's a screening of Kiki, with an after-screening discussion with myself from Cineque, Andrew and Eve, and also Kate from LASS. So it should be great. I've actually seen Kiki, and it's such an incredible film. It's like if Paris is Burning had like a modern spin on it, I guess.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Which is great, because we talk about Paris is Burning, that goes in like your first breath when you talk about really important queer films.
Yes.
Especially queer films featuring people of colour. And there hasn't been a lot of follow-up that you would say in the same sentence to name another film alongside that. So I think that's amazing that Kiki exists. And
but again, it's not an easy film to get hold of. I think I've seen it because it was at Dockfest.
Yeah. Mm.
So I'm in kind of a rare position where I get to see this amazing film that ticks all the boxes for me, but it's not otherwise easily available.
This is the thing, it's readily available online, but it isn't available in cinemas, and that's where the barrier comes in. You can't, like, the thing is, the film industry can't really turn around and say that we need people to support the film industry if they make it so hard for people to access the films that they want to see and make it so unaffordable for them to see those films. I think, like, Kiki is a brilliant film, not only because it shows queer people with colour perspectives, but also it talks about voguing, which is so central to, like, a queer person of colour like experience. Like, one of my first experiences on going out and having a group of queer people of colour was a voguing workshop, and then, like, having going out and voguing on a night out it's a very, very black thing. And it stems from black culture, and it stems from an acceptance. I think that's such a big thing that queer people of colour feel, that it's very close to our hearts. And so I don't think you can talk about queer black experiences without talking about voguing, because they're so intertwined. Especially, like, that the music of that time and the kind of attitudes of that time, and also breaking the rules, because when you don't have to adhere to anything, you don't have to follow the rules, you can just pave your own way. So yeah, go and see it. It's amazing.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for coming to join us today.
Thank you for having me.
The best time talking to you.
So, so good. Really. I'm going to make sure I watch all the films you've spoken about. So I think I've only seen one or two of them.
That's the best thing about this. We always come away with, like, a list of great films to go away after.
Yeah. The Queer Cinema Detective is on the case.
Do you want to
What was the one that you said, Jack?
Portrait of Jason.
Portrait of Jason. Yeah. All right. Okay.
It's so good. It's so interesting. Anyway, do you want to tell people where they can find out more about CineQ and the events that you put on?
So you can hear more about CineQ at our Twitter, which is at CineQ Brum. You can also hear about our Facebook, facebook.com/CineQ Brum. And then we have an Instagram, which is at CineQ Brum. And we're setting up our website so it can take tickets. So our website's currently down, but it will be CineQ .live.
Brilliant. So get yourselves to Birmingham and see some amazing films.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rico.
Bye.
Bye.
Lovely, smart, wonderful Rico.
I know.
That's what's going through my mind.
I know.
I've got a list as long as my arm of films I need to get watching.
Definitely.
And I just hope everybody really enjoyed that. And go to a CineQ event if you can get to one in Birmingham.
Absolutely.
I know we will be.
We will be. We're definitely going to be visiting some film events in Birmingham. So
absolutely. So that brings us to the end of this episode. So if you like the Cinema for All podcast, please rate and review us on iTunes.
Yeah, go on.
It goes a long way, doesn't it?
It does. It's so good.
Share it on social media, or even just tell your pals about it. We would be really grateful.
We would.
But for now, let's roll credits. Producer,
Jay Platt.
Logo designed by
Lydia Lipinski of Thoughts Make Things.
Hosted by
Jack Chell
and Abby Sandish. With thanks to
Rico Johnson Sinclair, Deborah Parker and Sheffield Live.
The Cinema for All podcast is supported by the BFI awarding funds from the National Lottery.
Thank you!